we want to make sure that equity is not just a nice to have, but a must have as part of this federal implementation. And so we are working with those on the ground who are using manufacturing jobs as a gateway to the middle class, but also as a gateway for racial equity.
That voice was Michelle Burris of the Century Foundation, talking about how manufacturing jobs in the 21st century are an important means for lifting the lives of all kinds of Americans and making it happen in all kinds of regions. Her interview coming up next on the podcast, Manufacturing and American Century.
Welcome, Americans. You're listening to the podcast, Manufacturing and American Century, with your host, Matt Boghossian.
Today, we are lucky enough to have with us the Century Foundation's Michelle Burris. How are you, Michelle?
I'm doing great. How are you, Matt?
I'm doing great. Thank you for being on the podcast, Manufacturing and American Century. For those
Thank
of you,
you
listening,
for having me.
Oh, of course, yeah. For those who aren't familiar with the Century Foundation, it's a think tank. Great history too, Michelle. Started in 1919, advancing policy developments from social security to election reform, homeland security, equity, and inclusion, which is what we're going to talk about. AMCC has been partnering with the Century Foundation since, I'd say, 2018, when their Andy Stettner helped us found AMCC. And so it's great that we've been able to work closely with you, Michelle, on strengthening American manufacturing. Tell us, I mean, there's a lot of reasons I'm psyched that you're on the podcast. You have a fascinating background yourself I want to get to in a little bit. But talk about one of the new tactics that you guys are employing at the Century Foundation with other partners to increase diversity in the manufacturing workforce.
Sure. Well, first, Matt, I just want to thank you for the warm invitation to be here. And in terms of a new tactic, we are building off of federal legislation that is promoting equity and inclusion as a part of the implementation. So as an example of that, we are particularly looking at the Good Jobs Challenge and the Build Back Better Regional Challenge, where the Department of Commerce wants to fuel workforce. They want to look at infrastructure. They want to look at the production of semiconductor chips. They want to look at manufacturing as a whole, and also provisions and apprenticeships as well across all three acts. And those three acts are the Inflation Reduction Act, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, and the Chips and Science Act. So we at the Century Foundation, we are trying to be a part of moving that needle. And we are leveraging and working with recipients of the Good Jobs Challenge and the Build Back Better Regional Challenge, particularly Ohio, the Ohio Manufacturers Association, and Detroit, Detroit Future City, and the Southeast Michigan Community Alliance, and in Chicago and Cook County, particularly the Cook County Bureau of Economic Development. So all three of these, or really all four of these awesome organizations, are using equity and infusing equity, particularly as they place workers, workers of color, into manufacturing careers. So we are working with them to provide technical assistance and consulting via our industry and inclusion program. And as you mentioned, Matt, that was started in 2020 by my colleague Andy Stettner to look at how can we leverage and how can we ensure that the nation's manufacturing, particularly now where about 800,000 manufacturing jobs need to be filled, how can we ensure that they make up the demographics, particularly the racial and gender demographics of the nation? And so we are actually in the third iteration of our industry and inclusion cohort. The second one focused on community colleges. The first one was community-based job training providers. And then this third iteration with this new tactic, we are doing consulting, we are providing technical assistance, and we are looking at how do we meet those goals? Because for us, we want to make sure that equity is not just a nice to have, but a must have as part of this federal implementation. And so we are working with those on the ground who are using manufacturing jobs as a gateway to the middle class, but also as a gateway for racial equity.
Wow, this is complex work, no doubt. I mean, you know, as folks listening to this podcast and are a part of AMCC and interact with us know, it's really complex system science. We talk about the big six, like for a region to thrive in manufacturing, it's got to be working well enough in all six of these areas. And one of them is workforce and training. And to your point, like, we have so much good hard work to make smarter products that solve problems, and we don't have enough people to do it. And we've got to tap into, you know, the diverse pool of great Americans out there. How do you guys, you know, so you're in your third round of this, private, public, nonprofit sector intervention. How do you, you know, how's it going so far?
We are just listening to our partners in Ohio, Cook County, and in Detroit to think about how do we provide the most help. And so, for example, in Ohio, they are looking at placing a little bit over 3,000 participants into good manufacturing jobs. And how do we help them meet that metric of ensuring that a certain percentage of people are of color? And so hearing the awesome work that Ohio is already doing with their industry sector partnerships across the state, hearing such great work that our partners are doing in Detroit and in Cook County has been very helpful for us as we think about how we want to go into the first cohort meeting and identifying the best subject matter experts to help provide that assistance. We're very excited that Andrew Crow, who is a leader in manufacturing across the nation based in St. Louis and just an incredible national voice, he's actually our facilitator for this cohort. So we're so thrilled and honored to have him. But it's really going great, just learning, really listening, because we think the first part is building trust and also just listening to what's happening on the ground. How can we work with these partners? How can we ensure that if someone has a metric of X percentage of people will be of color in these job training programs, and not only that, but be retained and still be there 6 months after, we want to make sure that that grant is, that that metric is maintained.
What about the ones that have started already? Like, how are they progressing?
In terms of our community colleges?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We can, I can brag on them for 2 hours. So I'll just...
well, I'll give just, us an example, like in one jurisdiction, you know?
Sure.
So folks listening from a region can say, okay, I can see what these kinds of interventions could mean for my region.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me try to go across the country. I'll start in California. One of our partners, Sierra College, they particularly hire women faculty to teach welding and manufacturing courses. And that helps significantly in the recruitment and in the retaining, particularly in their welding programs. So we had the opportunity to write about Sierra College. They're located near the Sacramento area. And we interviewed a student. She was a part of our roundtable who said that she would have never went into welding if it wasn't for her faculty member, Alita Vaughn, who is a welding instructor there. And the welding instructor leads with, when women join the welding department at Sierra College, they will not face harassment. This will not be a toxic environment. And she is committed to her students, particularly her women students, completing these welding programs and for the men to be allies. So that's one example. If I keep going across the country, we have College of Lake County. They are located in Grays Lake, Illinois. I had the opportunity to visit them in April. They just opened up an advanced technology center where they are really using the center and using their industry partnerships to really help recruit and retain more Latinx students in their manufacturing programs. They have the commitment of the president and they have the institutional commitment to really use this center to bring in more students. Another place, Bishop State Community College, located in Mobile, Alabama. They are our only historically Black community college. They have funding from the Jean Haas Foundation, and I was able to go down there for their ribbon cutting ceremony. They just opened a new center, particularly for advanced manufacturing in Mobile. And so they are reaching out and connecting to the nearly 50% of students who do not go on to any post-secondary path after high school, and upskilling them and training them in the workforce. Bishop State also has a program called Girls Learning About Manufacturing, led by Sharnay Hobbs and Ocarine Spears there, where they are recruiting and retaining young women of color in manufacturing. And so these women of color are paired with a mentor, and then they are placed in jobs such as at Alabama Power or in the Alabama Lineman Training, where they are learned to do well in manufacturing. And the percentage right now we are looking at is that only 6% of welders are women. On average. And so institutions like Sierra College and Bishop State, they are moving the needle and ensuring that that number gets higher. We then have Lorain County Community College. They are located in Elyria, Ohio. They do a fantastic job in their microelectronics mechanical assistance program. Intel is on the way, where there's going to be at least 3,000 jobs needed, particularly in semiconductor and in technicians. And Lorain County is doing a phenomenal job in helping to build that workforce and to solve the workforce challenge. And one more school, Forsyth Tech Community College. They're located in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And also, they are ensuring that Latinx students not only complete apprenticeship programs, but are hired and retained by their employers because they notice that gap. And they use that gap to bring on a consultant to help them figure out how do we work with our Latinx students to ensure when they complete these apprenticeship programs that their completion is just not done in vain, but that they actually go on to a manufacturing career. So those are just a few, but all of our cohort colleges, all 12, are just incredible. If I had another hour, I will go through the list individually. and I would be remiss if I didn't mention Milwaukee Area Technical College, where they upskill students with autism and computer numerical control manufacturing. And it's a phenomenal program called the Uniquely Abled Program, where students who are disabled or who are diagnosed with level one autism are paired with business partners and are mentored. During the cohort, Milwaukee Area Technical College had a 100% completion rate for their students and placed them into industry. And so seeing the impacts along racial, gender, and disability lines across the colleges was just phenomenal to be a part of.
Oh, yeah. It's so exciting. We've been exposed on some of our AMCC roadshow visits to the Uniquely Abled program. Just another example of all the talent that's out there that needs to be harnessed. It's exciting. You talked about the Good Jobs Challenge and the and other federal interventions. Can you talk, you know, it's obviously having a difference, you know, in regions around the country. Can you speak more about that? You know, but for these federal interventions, you know, it would be hard to bring people together. Talk about that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that we see in workforce, and I'm sure across all industries, a few industries, is that too often we work in silos. And so we don't know the incredible work that is being done because we're not having those conversations. And I really commend the Department of Commerce because in the beginning, even in order to apply and even in order to have a successful application, you had to show that you were working as a part of a coalition or an ecosystem. So for example, with the regional technology hubs as a part of the CHIPS and Science Act, you had to prove that you were in partnership with the local educational institution, including an HBCU or a community college or another minority serving institution. You had to show that you had had impact or you had some type of feedback from the community, and we're also working with a business partner. And so I think one of the great things that this federal funding is doing is encouraging people to come out of, well, really, it's mandatory to come out of the silos and work together, because that is really how we ensure that the people who are in most need of this funding have the direct benefits. And I think that's a wonderful thing that we're seeing, having to work in the ecosystems, because really that's how a lot of the work is done. Because an industry can say, you know, we need 60 people, new people on our production line. But if those 60 people who you want do not have childcare, do not have transportation, it's not going to be a successful attempt. So you need the community-based organizations who are working closer with the bus lines or with child care centers to connect and ensure that these people get to their jobs successfully. You need the community colleges to ensure that the training is aligned with what industry needs and the wraparound services that community colleges have. So everyone has to work together. I think that's really one great thing that we're seeing. And I think also just seeing the impacts and the intentionality of focusing on equity. Most of us are familiar with the Justice 40 initiative and the administration as well, where a certain percentage of projects must benefit environmental justice and communities that were impacted by environmental justice. You know, I grew up when Katrina occurred in New Orleans. And so seeing this intentionality around helping, working together and working with people who are most directly in those communities, I think is a really great thing of this federal funding. So again, for sure, the ecosystems, avoiding working in silos, and then people being able to have a direct impact in their communities instead of having to move outside of their local communities is really great coming out of the federal funding.
Yeah, and you're a great example. You're modeling that behavior. We're so grateful that you serve on the AMCC advisory board for AMCC and have for a long time. You talked about your experience in Katrina. Let's talk about you a little bit.
Sure.
You have a fascinating background, Michelle. You're fabulous to work with. I mean, as a Black woman in America, you are a super important model. And where did you grow up?
Sure. So I grew up in Washington, D.C. At the time, it was considered probably one of the least invested, I would say, communities in Washington, D.C., in Ward 8 of D.C. But I was fortunate to have parents, and I had grandparents who lived to be 96 and 91, who really invested in me being able to have access to a quality education. So whether that meant doing a commute, or whether that meant for me, I was really fortunate to be able to go to magnet school, where that really provided me the opportunities to learn about other people and to learn about other cultures. Fast forward, I was able to go, had the opportunity to go to Spelman College, which is, I believe, one of two only all African-American women's schools located in Atlanta, Georgia. And that was really where the confidence was really built up. The confidence was ingrained in me from my parents and grandparents, and then amplified being at Spelman and being in a community surrounded by so many, particularly Black women, who were thriving in STEM and thriving in their field of study. And after Spelman, joined the Peace Corps, which is really was a game changer for me. Right after college, moved to Rwanda and taught English at a boarding school. I was the only African-American volunteer in my community, and this was during 2014, so President Obama was still in office, and, you know, people would openly say, you know, well, we've never seen an African-American before, we've never interacted with them. People always thought that I was actually directly from the continent and could never really connect me to being an American, and so... Mm-hmm. Part of my role, even though I was there to teach English, I pivoted a little bit. I continued to teach English, but really teaching about culture and racial diversity and Peace Corps. And so people think, oh, the Peace Corps, you know, you're going 2 years without electricity or without running water. That wasn't the challenge. The challenge was really teaching racial identity. And I wasn't expecting that, particularly coming out of an HBCU and being surrounded by so much cultural identity. And then having to explain it, but I stayed there because I enjoyed my students. I love their eagerness to learn. I love my colleagues, their eagerness to learn about race and the history of race in America, and also being able to learn from them. And that's when I moved to New York and went to graduate school, and then applied all over to different jobs and didn't hear back anything, almost about 50 applications. And so I ended up working in environmental education, went back to D.C. and had a master's degree from Columbia, but got paid to pick up trash and loved it and loved working with students, picking up trash and playing basketball and building bridges. And through that time, we were able to do beautification and the reopening of a new park in D.C. And it was great to be there with the team. They had a ribbon cutting ceremony. We were on the D.C. local news. So part of my life's mantra is just embracing the detours, because you don't know where that life will take you. And that's when I saw an email that the Century Foundation is hiring, and went ahead and applied, and have been at the Century Foundation since 2019. But when I say embracing the detours, it's just, you never know where one path can lead. It was because of one person who I met in a computer lab who said, you need to do the Peace Corps, where I looked more into the Peace Corps. And before that, too, it was President Obama made a video encouraging more people to join the Peace Corps, and that inspired me. And then before that, his wife, First Lady Michelle Obama, at the time I was I had the opportunity to intern in her office coming out of high school, and she did the commencement speech at Spelman College. And so I ended up transferring to Spelman off of the inspiration of her commencement speech. And because one of her personal aides had went to Spelman and who encouraged me to apply. And so embracing the detours in life, which has led me here, and to my wonderful former colleague, Andrew Stettner, who kind of picked up the phone one random afternoon and sent me the job description for this role as a fellow leading this industry and inclusion work, and just taking it and running with it. And so embracing the detours and just grateful for all the people who have helped me along the way.
Yeah, for sure. Taking the road less traveled, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And we're all benefiting from that. Michelle, you're a great colleague, we're very fortunate. You're talking about the HBCUs and, you know, your whole, you know, leadership on DEI and manufacturing. You know, you have this intervention experiment going on, the cohort work with the Century Foundation. Take a step back, mm-hmm. you know, and talk to regional leaders, you know, that might not be, might not be a part of your cohort experiment with the Century Foundation. What are some tactics that, you know, regional leaders can use to, bring more diversity into their manufacturing workforce?
Sure. I would say the first step is identifying the community college in your area. And the end goal is to establish some type of MOU or articulation agreement to develop workforce and talent development programs. And the reason why I'm leading with educational institutions is because community colleges tend to be the most diverse. They're going to be the most diverse typically in that community. And if you want your region's workforce to be reflective of the overall demographics of the workforce, I would start really with the community colleges. And also because the community colleges typically have a relationship usually with the public high schools, because we know, particularly in manufacturing, we want to get students invested and we want to get them head on usually by 8th grade or at least by 10th or 11th grade. And so we don't want to wait until they're entrenched in a major to try to pull them. We want to get them at that early age and have that type of exposure. So as a regional leader, I would start with the community college identification of who is the dean of workforce there, who is the director of DEI, who is a dean of a particular program that you identify as having maybe a workforce shortage in the area, and working with them to have those types of conversations. So if it's, you know, for example, manufacturing, working with that deans of manufacturing, we see the same thing in healthcare as well as in IT. I would say that that's definitely a first. And then I would say having multiple touch points a year to really identify and have a solution for the tangible and concrete steps that you are going to take to meet that goal. Because one issue that we find is that someone can say, oh, we have a relationship with a community-based partner or a community college, but there's a meeting once a year. So, or it's a meeting and it's like, well, great. It ends with a great to see you and talk again soon. But we have to have the accountability and the action steps in order to get this done. Because we want regions to thrive. And we know also that ideally, if you want people to stay in the region, you have to have partnerships. I visited Hawkeye Community College in June, and just in great admiration of what they do and how they have partnerships with the public schools in Waterloo, Iowa, and how they have partnerships with the Career Center, and also how the mayor, I was able to see the mayor's kids who are under 18 in a summer camp at the community college. So seeing how this regional leader is invested in continuing to build the city of Waterloo and also in the community colleges and seeing that whole ecosystem work well together. It's just one example, particularly because Waterloo is one of the most diverse cities in Iowa, and seeing that investment, and they also have a 2030 vision to continue building Waterloo through the partnerships of people like Hawkeye, institutions like Hawkeye Community College. So I would just reiterate, starting with your local educational institutions, do not forget the community-based organizations, especially because although they may be low in capacity, they are mighty in their impact. And they are knocking on the doors of the person who may not read their mail or may not check their email and see about the opportunities for job training or for economic development. And so the community-based organizations, They have built the trust. They have established the relationship. So leveraging them and also funding them, because a lot of times they may not have the capacity and they may be underfunded. And so I would say those partnerships are really key. And I'll end this question with a quote someone had told me once, and he said, do what you do best and partner with the rest. And that was his best advice. And it rings true, you know, do what you can and partner, because there's people there to help and to help you get to those tangible solutions.
And you talked about a super important part within that, creating those robust partnerships. And that's consistency. You know, we're all trying to change the system for better. Systems leadership, we like to call it. And there's a whole kind of developing best practices of what good systems leaders are and do. And one of the things that they do is having consistent interactions, because unless you have consistent interactions, not the once a year thing like you're talking about, unless you have consistent interactions, you don't build the trust necessary to kind of reveal and take advantage of the opportunities that exist in those different silos if they were working together for collective impact. We've been lucky enough, like I was saying, with you on the AMCC board to have weekly interactions. We have our weekly calls. We have our weekly updates. It's like a muscle that needs to be exercised, you know, to strengthen it. And that goes, you know, true for any kind of a collective impact effort like AMCC across the country, but within each of these regions, like a region that wants to strengthen its workforce and training ecosystem in manufacturing, those stakeholders, you got to not only, you know, there's a lot of parts to the challenge, right? Is contacting them, building a relationship and trust, and then continuing to strengthen that muscle with consistent interactions. What have you seen out there in terms of like how regional partners, you know, create those consistent interactions?
Yeah, I would say industry roundtables for sure. And I'll just give an example of what we did in our cohort. We hosted three industry roundtables. One was in person in Ohio, and we did two virtual. And I think being able to have those roundtables that are composed of relevant stakeholders. And so for us, it was the employer, it was the community college, it was an actual student, because the student needs to be able to share their own personal experiences, and employer, community, and maybe a mentor who was there just to speak about the experiences. And those roundtables were integral just for us to be able to hear the different experiences that people are having and to be able to identify solutions. And so we wrote about, for example, our roundtable in Ohio, where we had a student who was able to, she was an African-American welding student who has now since graduated, but was able to talk about her experience of how successful Lorain County Community College was as recruiting her for manufacturing. But she also spoke that she was very fortunate to be recruited for welding, and that some of her other students, colleagues, they may have felt a little hesitant or reluctant to try to reach out or express interest in the programs. And so what I'm seeing most is the industry roundtables have helped, because they bring diverse, but they bring relevant stakeholders to the table. And then they allow for kind of those multiple touch points, because everyone is local. Then people are able to come together and establish a cadence of meeting with each other to have those types of meetings. And so I would say the industry roundtables have really been the most helpful. We hear of different things as well called community town halls, where people can go in and talk to their council member or talk to someone who is in charge of the workforce, particularly in that local council, which is really helpful too. And I would say too, you have to know your context, because in some states, the statewide is the major sphere of influence, and you want to talk to, you know, whoever is representing your state. But in some areas, the localized presence is the most important, and it is that city council member. It is kind of your commissioner who is really going to be helping you move the needle. And so I would say, especially for someone who may not be from that particular state, to really have an understanding of the landscape there, particularly if this is more of a state heavily influenced or more of a local there's a quote that says all politics is local, and sometimes that's maybe can be true very much so for workforce and in talent development. So being able to know your landscape, and also what we've always said is just identifying who are those local champions. And it may just be one, but sometimes you just need one champion as a sounding board to bring in other people. And so as I continue to reiterate, you know, don't do this work alone if you don't have to, because people are able to help you establish trust and those who know the landscape to kind of really build that momentum and move the needle.
Well, talk about moving the needle. You're moving the needle, Michelle, and you're obviously fired up about this work. Can you tell folks why it's complex work, but mm-hmm. why you're so excited about it and you know, psyched about doing it? Yeah.
Sure. Wow, it's a great question. I would say on the federal policy lens, which is where the Century Foundation, that's kind of our, if you will, bread and butter, just seeing the successful passage of the CHIPS and Science Act, that was really, I think, Matt, you went to the signing of it at the White House and my colleague, Andrew Stettner. And I know before I even came to the Century Foundation, that was a lot of labor and a lot of just talking and meetings that occurred in order to see the successful passage of the act, and particularly the regional technology hubs, which in the act has language that one third of those hubs will be for economically disadvantaged communities. And seeing that it passed, and seeing that now communities all over the country can benefit from the regional technology hubs and it being appropriated, shows that policy change does work. And advocating for policy does work. And Matt, you mentioned since 2018, you know, the CHIPS and Science Act passed in 2022. But just seeing that, you know, you have to celebrate those small wins. And then it's a party when you get to those big wins around the CHIPS and Science Act. So just seeing that it's just an incredible thing to see. And I would say for me personally, just seeing, I want, from my own personal life, you know, as I mentioned, I was very fortunate to go to a magnet school, but I had a full awareness that so many people from my zip code did not. There were just total different trajectories, being kind of stuck in jobs with stagnant wages or not having the economic opportunity that they could have had had they had the opportunity to go to a magnet school. And I was very fortunate to be able to go to a magnet school, an HBCU, a community college, and an Ivy League school, and just to see all the differences and opportunities, particularly when I went to school. I went to a segregated middle school and then a very diverse magnet school. And so for me, it should never only be just about me. It should be about the other students in my neighborhood. It should be about other women of color who can benefit from these same opportunities. But that only gap is access to opportunities and exposure. And too often, too many people just don't have that exposure. And we have a lot of work to do. We have a lot of work to do in ensuring that when that 16-year-old junior in high school hears the word manufacturing, it clicks for them. Robotics, being able to do mechatronics, being able to work with their hands, being able to be innovative. We want that message to be articulated, and we still have work to do to ensure that it is. And so that matters to me, being able to create opportunities when, especially when we still have a racial wealth gap, as I mentioned before, when we still see that the participation of people of color in manufacturing is not reflective of the nation's demographic as a whole, when we see that approximately 30% of women work in the manufacturing sector, although the women's labor participation rate is about 59%, we see the data. The data is all there. And I'll last say, too, just the history of it. We know historically that manufacturing was a gateway to the middle class for African Americans, particularly for those who did not possess a four-year degree. So we know the stories of the African Americans who moved from the Deep South to escape racist violence to Chicago and to Detroit and to Ohio for these manufacturing opportunities. And then when deindustrialization occurred, having the closures of these factories and not, no longer having a job, no longer being able to provide for your family. And so the history of what manufacturing has meant for so many African Americans in particular, I can name two family members off the top of my head who were a part of just the manufacturing boom. It means a lot, and we want to revitalize that history. We hear so many times, particularly when President Biden makes a speech, you know, manufacturing is back, and the Rust Belt will be the Silicon Heartland. You know, we want to mean it, and we want to make sure that no one gets left behind. So that's what this means for me.
Well, thanks to you for doing a lot of this good hard work, and we're delighted to be partners with you, friends with you. I'm delighted to be friends with you, and I'm grateful for your work, Century Foundation Fellow and co-manager of the Industry and Inclusion Cohort, Michelle Burris. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Matt. Thank you, AMCC, for having me. An honor to be on here.
You can learn more about AMCC and joining our weekly mailing list at americanmcc.org/subscribe. If you're a manufacturer, economic development professional, workforce and trading person, capital provider, or work in any field critical to American manufacturing, send us a note. We'd love to hear about progress from your part of the ecosystem and join us on our Monday calls. The next episode of this podcast, Manufacturing in American Century, will be coming out soon. So in the meantime, spread the word by sharing about AMCC and the podcast on your Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Manufacturing in American Century is available on Spotify and all major podcast platforms. Thanks for our production partners, AMCC Operations Director David Van Sicklin and Mr. Mike McCallum from Podcasting for Associations. That's it for now. I'm Matt Bogosian with you, Manufacturing in American Century.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man.